This episode of the Mr. Martin Maths Podcast is proudly supported by Casio and their lovely ClassPad platform. Now, what is ClassPad, I hear you say? Well, it's the new Casio web-based emulator platform, and I tell you what, it's flipping brilliant. ClassPad incorporates all models of the ClassWiz emulator, so you can project your calculator nice and big on your screen so your students can see, but it also does so much more. Now, I've been playing around with it this morning, and I tell you what, you can produce graphs, investigate geometric shapes, generate data sets, form number lines, and tons more besides. And I'll tell you what I found the best, and that is each of these mathematical representations can be displayed next to each other on an infinite canvas alongside the calculator, allowing your students to see the connections between them. Now, I'm delighted to say that Casio are long-term sponsors of the podcast this year, so I look forward to telling you more about the wonderful work they're doing to support the teaching and learning of maths. And if you're a teacher that's currently juggling the transition from older Casio models to the new fancy ClassWiz range, then the ClassPad emulator will allow you to quickly and easily switch between old and new calculators and model the maths appropriately for your students, whichever Casio calculator they have in their hands. So, to find out about all the incredible support available to UK teachers, here's the place you need to go. education.casio.co.uk/Mr-Barton-Maths. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And welcome to another episode of the Mr. Barton Maths Podcast with me, Craig Barton, a show where I interview people who interest and inspire me from the wonderful world of education. This is the 11th, can you believe it, in the series of monthly conversations with my good friend and podcasting enemy, Ollie Lovell. Each month we reflect upon three things we've tried, seen or been thinking about over the last few weeks. This time around, because Ollie, as you'll hear, isn't quite feeling himself, we discussed just five things. Firstly, the importance of the choice of examples we share with our students. Then Ollie's reflections upon Pritesh Raychura's use of hands up cold call. That's an interesting one. Then I share my 5-point charter that I'm asking all head teachers to sign up to before I give school support. Bit controversial. Then Ollie reflects upon behaviour systems. And finally, I share a common thing I'm seeing teachers do that I think is a mistake. Just a reminder to sign up for my two newsletters, that's the Tips for Teachers newsletter and the ED newsletter, for more educational goodness in your inboxes each week. I've got one ED newsletter coming up, in fact it'll probably be out by the time this is out, if not next week, where I share my coaching and lesson observation template and an example of a teacher that I went through that process with. I think you might find that useful. So to receive that and all the lessons that I learn from my school visits each week, just sign up for my two newsletters, Tips for Teachers and ED newsletter. There'll be links to those in the show notes. Okay, enjoy the show. Ollie Lovell, how are you, mate?
Not very well.
Oh, flipping heck. What a start to the show. Go on, what's up?
I've just been really sick. So what is it, Thursday? Tuesday I was in bed like all day, just all night with a flu. I could barely open my eyes without feeling like vertigo.
Jeez. Kind of a thing.
And then yesterday I managed to do about 2 hours work, most of it lying in bed. Today I did probably get about 6 hours work today, but definitely had to have another nap just before our chat today. But ready and raring to go, Craig.
But you've been, because we're recording this slightly later than we normally would do in the month, because you've been super busy like the last few weeks as well. Do you reckon you're just a bit run down?
I think that might have been it, yeah. So I used the Easter long weekend to spend about 25 hours trying to learn how to do statistical analysis of my PhD data. And I think that just was the straw that broke the camel's back. in this case. But it was really fun. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Jeez, well, good on you. I mean, good on you turning up for the podcast anyway, Ol. That's yeah, sign thanks, of mate. Your dedication to the cause. Good
effort
there.
I know how grumpy it makes you when I reschedule, which I've done on you far too many times, Craig. So I wanted to try to stick to it if I could.
You're a good man. You're a good man. Hey, well, I'll tell you what. Just before we dive in, I brought this to show you, right?
Oh, mate. I was keen when I saw you drinking from that when you popped up on the screen, because you mentioned green smoothies a couple of episodes ago, and you were like, I'll tell you about that later, and then we never got around to it. And I've been wanting to get into these green smoothies, but I haven't known how, so...
Right, game changer here, listeners. So if you don't want to feel like Ollie, and instead you want to feel like me, what you need is you need to change your breakfast. So for 38 years or something like that, I've been on Weetabix every day for breakfast. And I was up to about 5 Weetabix, 5.5 sometimes if Isaac only had it, if there was a half left over. Love Weetabix. But I thought I'm just going to change things around. So what I have now, gone completely cold turkey, no Weetabix. So every morning, I put 4 kind of cylinders of frozen spinach, 4 broccoli florets, 1 handful of kale, a chopped banana, scoop of vanilla protein powder, scoop of creatine, scoop of this mono summit that this guy told me is good for stamina, so that goes in there as well. Scoop of this like green superfood powder thing that's got a few probiotics in and blah blah blah.
Spirulina or something.
So God knows what's in there. And then 2 scoops of peanut butter, just to give it a bit of texture and stuff. I originally then filled it up with milk, but it was too much. So now I'm pure water, blended up in the blender, and I'm absolutely flying. But right, here's the twist. I've never felt better, right, physically, sleeping better and everything. But I did one of those blood tests a couple of weeks ago, I think, because a few of my friends were doing it who were a similar age. So I thought, I'm just going to pay for one of these blood tests. Surely everything will be fine. Everything comes back absolutely fine, apart from kidney, where I've got abnormally high levels of urea, which is a sign of severe kidney damage. I was like, what? Looked into it, and it's basically, if you're taking protein supplements, you're in a bit of trouble with this. So it recommended I go and see the doctor. So I'm seeing the doctor today, and I know what they're going to say. They're going to say, stop taking this protein and creatine, and then do another blood test. But I don't want to, because I feel absolutely, I'm lifting more in the gym. I'm feeling great, but it's destroying my kidney, unfortunately. So yeah, that's where I'm at with that. So this could be killing me, this green shake, but I absolutely love it.
That's really interesting, mate. Yeah, I'm definitely keen on that. I'll have to become a patron of your podcast and get a transcript and then get the recipe out of it that you just spoke out, that you just narrated, and then I'll be on it too.
But it might finish me off. That's the only slight downside
to
it.
And a blood test. Who'd you get the blood test through?
Newman, it's like the big one that everyone does over here. It was like,
okay,
80 quid or something like that. It was like, okay, a real brilliant breakdown. But yeah, apart from the fact that abnormally high levels of urea and creatine or something like that. So I'll see what the doctor says. Fingers crossed I'll still be around to record with you next month, but who knows?
I'm sure you will be. Make sure you get a second opinion from ChatGPT as well.
Don't you worry about that.
That's my go-to.
Right, so in a new twist, Ol, you want me to go first. Is that right with this?
Yeah, because I'm not sure how long I'm going to last, so I may only have 2 in me, 2 takeaways in me, Craig.
All right, let's do it. So, right, you'll need your energy for this one, so I'll front load the biggie first. So a little bit of background. The 2 best things I've read in the last 12 months in the world of education are your best mate Josh Goodridge's book, and I thought it's absolutely brilliant, Responsive Coaching, and I put out a conversation I had with Josh previous episode.
Great podcast, really, really enjoyed it, mate.
Thanks,
you,
mate.
You did a great job.
And then the other one, which we've teased a few times on this show, is I'm reading Chris Bolton's book that's about 12 years in progress, and he's up to chapter 2 on it. So anyway, I've read chapter 1 and read chapter 2, and it's phenomenal. So he's coming on the show in 2 weeks. So what I thought I'd do is I'd just drip feed. I mean, there's so much in the book, but I'd just drip feed one takeaway that's had a bit of a profound effect already on some of the coaching work I've done, some of the work I've done planning with teachers. And that is choice of examples. Now, I think this is a bit underrated. I, again, just speaking for myself, it was one of the parts of the lesson I would think the least about. I'd just rock up and just like make up an example either on the spot or whichever was one was in the PowerPoint. And it wouldn't really matter because I thought, well, this is just the first worked example. Then we're going to do a we do. Then they're going to do a load of practice and so on. So that first example that I demonstrate, it's not that important. And what I would, if I put any thought of it into it at all, it would be to make it super simple, a real basic example that we then would go and build from. But over the last few years, I've rethought this a little bit, and I've got a few kind of principles that I use when I'm thinking about my example. And then Chris has added a new principle to this through reading the book. So I thought I'd share my original principles with you, if that's okay. Mm. And then I'll talk about this new principle from Chris. So I've got it here. Let me just fire it up. So my first principle is to not use prototypical examples exclusively. So what you often see is when we're doing area of a triangle, I mean, triangles are bad for this. When you do an area of a triangle, it's typically either you kind of a right angle triangle with a base and a kind of vertical height, or it's an isosceles triangle. And the problem with this is that kids start to associate the formula or the process with one very kind of specific looking example. So that when things get mixed up a bit and you get a triangle that doesn't have a horizontal base in inverted commas, or it doesn't have a vertical height, then they're a bit screwed. So starting with a weirder looking example and using prototypical examples almost as kind of special cases or just an additional case, I think is quite a smart idea there. So that's idea one. I'd had that for a while. Idea two, or principle two, is to choose examples that avoid spawning misconceptions. Now, there's a few of these knocking around. So the obvious one is you never want to use 2 squared when you're doing anything with powers or anything like that, because you get the answer 4, whether you do it correctly or whether you add them or whatever. It's 2 squared's really bad. And then when kids do 9 squared, they say 18 and or even 11 or something like that. So that's a bad one. But there are other ones as well. So 10% is a bad one if you think about it. So when you're doing percentage of an amount, find 10% of 70 kilograms. Well, to find 10%, you just divide by 10. So then there's a danger. To find 5%, you divide by 5 and so on. And there are loads of these around. Like you can accidentally choose a set of data where the mean is the same value as the median, and that can confuse kids and so on. So just thinking, could this example spawn any misconceptions? Or in a better way to say that is, could the kids get it right for the wrong reason? So yeah, that's a principle I've had in for a while. Principle three that I've had for a bit is when you do that first example, you want to focus on the core concept and don't weave in anything else. So an obvious thing here is if you're doing something like perimeter, you don't want to chuck a decimal in there early on or a fraction in there early on. You want all the focus to be on perimeter. But it's even more subtle than that. So I watched a lesson a while ago, which was on angles on a straight line. And the first example the teacher gave was find this missing angle, and it was angle A, and on the other side of the line was 92 degrees. And the problem there was the kids, they weren't, their kind of number bonds and arithmetic skills weren't at the point where they could immediately kind of do the 180 subtract 92. So all their attention, or a big chunk of their attention, was on doing that calculation. So therefore, whenever it then came to little twists with this, they hadn't been thinking hard enough about the actual concept of angles on a straight line. All their attention had been on the arithmetic, so they were a bit screwed a bit later on. So keep the arithmetic as simple as possible and don't weave in anything else. I think it's a fairly straightforward one. As I said, these are the boring ones. These are just my ones. Oh, this one I quite like. I came up with this one. Avoid repeating elements within a worked example. So I'll give you an example of this. So I saw a lesson where the teacher was teaching solving equations, and it was x over 2 subtract 2 equals 10. And the problem with that is the teacher's saying, so the first thing we're going to do is we're going to get rid of this 2. Well, which 2? And sure, the teacher's pointing at it, but if the kids have missed that, or, you know, it just adds an additional complication that you don't need. So you want, when you've got your example, you want unique elements in there so that when you talk about the two, there's no doubt about which two you're talking about. So they're my four. I'll just recap those. And then it's up to you whether you want to come back at any of them, or I can just dive straight into Chris's. So my four are: don't use prototypical examples exclusively, Choose examples that avoid spawning misconceptions or that kids can get right for the wrong reasons. Focus initially on the core concept and nothing else, and avoid repeating elements within an example. So they're my four, but I've got a bonus one for you. What do you reckon to those, Ol?
Nice. Yeah, I think they make total sense, Craig. Well, I guess what I'm doing is listening and trying to draw connections between that and things that I've heard before, things that to help it make sense to me. One of them in particular jumps out, you know, focus on the core concept and don't weave in other things. That's like classic cognitive load theory. Remove anything that's extraneous, kind of an idea. The avoid repeating elements, or, I mean, in your example, you were kind of talking about repeating numerals. That's interesting. That's something that I've noticed more recently as well, actually, and been paying more attention to. I don't think there's like a cognitive load effect in relation to that. It's almost like a duplication of information, or maybe it's something related to split attention, because the students are kind of working out which of the numerals you're referring to. So they're like, yeah, attention is divided in space. And then the other ones, like, I couldn't agree more. Don't use prototypical examples exclusively, and choose examples that avoid spawning misconceptions. I think that one of the challenges of those things, as we've talked about lots in the past, is like how teachers go about building the knowledge of what is the kind of an example that spawns a misconception. And obviously the answer is use the diagnostic questions website. But I've been spending too long chatting now, Craig. Definitely agree. I think they're four excellent principles, and I'm keen to hear what Chris had come up with as well.
All right. So Chris is one. And I've kind of reworded this. And again, this is all kind of my interpretation of Chris's work, and I've not had a chance to talk to him. So usual disclaimers apply with this. But what I took from it is start with general examples, not easy specific cases. So I'll give you the examples he uses for this, and then I'll tell you how this has really changed the way I teach a particular thing. So he says that, like, let's say you're teaching expanding double brackets. A classic way to start will be something like x plus 4, x plus 3. Expand those, multiply out those brackets. You've got two positive signs. You've the coefficient on the x is the 1. Numbers are simple, and so on and so forth. But the problem with that is, and he gives a really nice example of this, that it's almost a special case, because the coefficient of the x is 1, you're always going to get x squared as a result. The kids can think, well, I just move that number, the plus 3, to in front of the x to give me one of the terms, the plus 4 in front of the other x to give me the other term, and then I add them together and so on. And it's a little bit like that idea of spawning the misconceptions. Kids can start to get those questions right, but for the wrong reason. So what Chris says is, instead, if you want them to focus on the correct process for multiplying out these double brackets, it's much better to start with, and he uses the example, 2x plus 4 brackets 10x plus 3. Because there, the numbers are nice and simple still, but there's no way that the child can get it right for the wrong reason. They have to spot that the multiplication's happening, and 10's a really nice number to spot where things are multiplying together. There's no way that they can think, well, it's always an x squared, because it's not always an x squared, it's a 2x squared, and so on and so forth. So there's one example. I've got a few more for you here. But that's an example where choosing a slightly, potentially more difficult example actually allows students to follow the process a bit clearer. So I thought that was a nice one. Like, I'll give you a couple of other ones. So then he says that this one really got me. So he says, which is easier, or which is better would be the way I phrase this, to start with if you're teaching gradient. Do you want a line where the gradient's 3? And he's got an example here of a line where it kind of goes across 2 and up 6. So do you want to start with that, working out the gradient's 3? And my answer is, yeah, of course you do. That's always how you start gradient. But he says, or is it better to start with a line whose gradient is 4/3? And when you think about it, if you want students to focus on gradient being how far you go across divided by how far you go up and down, you don't want 3, because, well, where's the down bit there? Where's the denominator of the fraction? Then kids have got to realize, well, actually 3 is the same as 3/1 and blah, blah, blah. So he says, no, start with the fraction and then use the three as the special case that comes later on. So completely flipping the order around that I would normally present those examples. And he's got one more as well. This one, I'm thinking maybe he's pushing it too far on this. So he does difference of two squares, factorizing. So he says, is it easier to start with something like x squared subtract 16? And again, that's typically how I would always start something like that. Or, wait till you hear this one, 9x to the power of 14 subtract 16y to the power of 10. And I'm thinking, bloody hell. But the point he makes, right, is that if you can follow that second example, you know exactly why the difference of two squares things work. And you know exactly what's happening to those powers, that you're not getting mixed up of whether they're, those powers are halving or whether you're, you know, subtracting whatever from them. You're not thinking, the x squared always just goes to an x. You're actually focusing on those coefficients. So if you start with the general case, you can then move to those specific cases a little bit later. So I just thought that was really, really interesting. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
I mean, I love that so much. That's fantastic. When we were revamping the StepLab sequence, I actually hired Chris for a couple of hours.
Did you?
To pick his brain on a sequence of steps we had around giving clear explanations. And what that guy knows about giving clear and detailed explanations is just phenomenal. I guess the most general comment I want to start by making is that, like, the power of this tip, start with general examples, not easy specific cases, is that it actually operationalizes a word that I've had trouble saying on your podcast in the past, Craig, but I've been practicing ever since. It operationalizes your first two points. Mm-hmm. So your first two ones were, don't use prototypical examples exclusively. So if we follow Chris's advice, we don't do that.
Yeah.
The second one was, choose examples that avoid spawning misconceptions. Yeah. It's a little bit harder to see, perhaps, but actually, if you use these general examples, well, the way that students make misconceptions often arise is that students recognize some shortcut that they can make.
Yeah, that's it.
That works in this simplified version of the question, but actually, that's not an appropriate generalization, right? And so if you start with a sufficiently general example, they can't draw a misconception from that, because it's just not possible. So I love that. And it's something that I was increasingly pushing towards 2 years ago when I was teaching further maths, because we were finding that students were getting really confused with problems that, as the problem type changed, they had to do more and more things. And it's like the gradient. It's like the gradient thing. You know, you're going to teach it in one way, but then, and in a simple way, and then a week later you say, okay, here's another example of how it might look. And if it looks like this, then you need to do this. And it's like 3 weeks later, you've told them that, like, if it looks like this, you do this. If it looks like this, you do this, blah, blah, blah. And the student's like, I'm completely overwhelmed. Like, why do you keep on making this harder and harder? But if you just teach, like, a five-step process in the first place that backtracks all of the potential complications they're ever going to deal with, and then reinforce that for 3 weeks, they're actually just super solid, and they're, like, they're bulletproof in terms of coming across any question. So I think, like, I think it's a really, really powerful way to approach teaching. The other thing it does is it pushes us to be much clearer and much more precise about how we introduce things in the first place, hopefully, or if not, it just is going to confuse our students even more. And that, you know, that can only be a good thing, I think, really pushing for that clarity in the first place.
Nice one, mate. Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. I love the idea of the shortcut. That's a good way. I'm going to use that when I explain this. And again, I was thinking, do I need to get my principles down from 5 to 4, because is this the same thing as not choosing examples that spawn misconceptions? Or, as you say, maybe even combine this, maybe this solves the prototypical thing. So I've just got to think whether this is now a list of 5 or a list of 4.
I think it's potentially 3. You've got to start with general examples, and that covers your first 2, I think.
Yeah.
And then focus on the core concept, which is, you know, remove redundancy. And then avoid repeating elements, which is like a very specific thing. It's not quite the same level of granularity, I don't think. But it's but it's still really valuable. There might actually be a number of things like that, avoid repeating elements, that are more at the like cognitive load effect level rather than the I don't know what you call it, the problem selection level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I can get it down to three. The example that I was going to give as well of something that I've completely changed my mind about, and I don't know if we've mentioned this before in the past, but Chris has given me a framework to think about this, is when I teach enlargements, I always start from a center enlargement of 0, 0, always. And the problem with that is, so say you enlarge in a shape from a center enlargement 0, 0 by scale factor 2, your mental shortcut that the kids can do is they say, oh, just double the value of all the coordinates and you get the answer. And then what do I do then? Scale factor 3, or let's just triple them. Scale factor 1/2, let's just halve them. And then lo and behold, 5 examples time, we're moving the center enlargement to something else and the whole world falls apart. So now 0, 0 is going to be the special case I come to towards the end, and I'm going to start with a trickier one so that they focus on the process. So yeah, it's just a nice way of thinking about things.
Yeah, that's a great example. One that came to mind immediately for me was teaching like rotations around a point as well. You know, similar shortcuts can be made if you start at 0, 0, and then students are completely done when you start to move the origin. So excellent point.
Love it. All right, Sol. Well, you seem to have come to life there. You're on good form responding to that. So you're back in the game. I like this. Right, what have you got for us? What's your first one?
I was just excited by a good idea about teaching and learning, Craig. It woke me up. I'm actually bringing us back to something that has come up in a previous podcast with yourself and Pratesh. And this is the idea of hands up cold call. Now, I'll say the first time I heard this, I was like, okay, I kind of get that. I see how it's like a good first check for engagement that then you might use it sometimes to be like, how many of you are with me? Who's tuned in, who isn't, and be like, okay, that's really interesting. I might call from someone who's put their hands up and then I'll use cold call later and so on. But I was pushed to dive a little bit deeper into it when at one of the trainings recently that I was running, someone came up to me and they'd been listening to a few of your podcasts and things like that. And I said, oh, I got a question for you. What about if you're using hands up cold call and you just get the same students who don't put their hands up all the time? Now you probably asked this of Pratesh in the podcast, and I listened to that podcast, but I couldn't remember. And so I thought that it would be worth exploring again on your podcast, because I'm sure I wasn't the only person who couldn't remember. And I thought, that's a good question. So I Googled it. Luckily, Pratesh had actually written a Twitter thread since that actually explicitly addresses this. But basically what he was saying, and it was a bit of a surprise to me, but it shouldn't have been, and in fact, reading it was a real revelation, is actually, I might just read some of it. I might just read it.
So what, for the benefit of listeners, will you just give us a bit of an overview of what hands-up cold call is versus kind of traditional cold call as well?
Sure, I'll give my best attempt, and then I've probably forgotten what that is as well, so you can fill in any gaps, okay? No, so I mean, my idea of a cold call is that you're basically asking a question to the whole class, not signaling to the class who you're going to ask to respond. And the point of this is that you are forcing every student to think about the question because they don't know if they're going to get called on or not, right? And then that's the purpose of the first part of it. And then you're going to randomly call on a student. You know, whether you do that randomly or not is a bit of a question, a point of debate, but let's say randomly for now. You call on a student, that represents a random sample, so you're not getting a biased sample of who's understanding, and then you're going to hear what that student says, and you know, might do that a few times and then base your next teaching move on that. So that's standard cold call. Now, the idea of hands up cold call, from what I recall, is same thing, except instead of every student sitting there with their hand down, as soon as they feel like they know the answer or a answer, they're going to raise their hand. And so you kind of have two points of data instead of one. The first point of data is how many students have put their hand up and how many have left theirs down, giving you a sense of who thinks they know the answer. And then the second point of data is when you actually check and then you say, okay, whether that individual student who you called on does know the answer or not. So that's my understanding of no hands up cold call versus all hands up cold call. So basically, Here, I'm going to read some of what Pratesh wrote. A key difference between no hands up cold calling and all hands up cold calling is that the latter very visibly highlights the buy-in in your classroom. It's very exposing. This is terrifying, but it's also a gift. The bravery will help you become a better teacher because it forces you to do something about the problem of students coasting in lessons. Why aren't all of your students bought in? Demanding all hands up reveals to you which individuals aren't participating. This data is a gift and key to addressing the issue. Make a list of these students. And this is where it starts to get interesting. Seek these students out to have a chat with them at break or lunch. What's stopping them from participating? G them up. Show them you believe in them. Tell them you have high standards and that you will hold them to account because you want them to succeed. Tell them you care. All Hands Up forces school leaders to take responsibility for the culture in their schools. You can collect all the data you like on assessment and behavior on a spreadsheet, but All Hands Up using checks for listening is the easiest test in the world that will show you what you need to prioritize. If students in your school aren't participating, they aren't learning. So yeah, just the idea that it's not, I mean, it sounds silly as I say it now because it's kind of like, there's an interesting analogy here, but it's not just that you're getting a data point to say, oh, that's interesting how many students think they know it. It's that you actually act on that data point, the attentional data point outside of class, because realistically, that's probably something you're going to have to do. Acting on it outside of class, going around to students and putting in that relational time to make sure that they're at a point where they're both sufficiently confident and sufficiently bought in to raise their hand and say, I can have a go and I want to have a go at answering that question. And when you put it in perspective like that, I mean, it's not surprising that Pratesh got the most impressive results in the country, right? Because of that commitment to driving a culture of like a hunger for learning. Because ultimately, that's the thing that drives learning, right? The culture and the desire to learn, as long as the teacher's being sufficiently clear in structuring practice, etc., well enough. So if he's doing that, and if he has it's not even a check for listening. It's like a check for buy and a check for learning culture in many ways. I think that's like incredibly powerful and like really inspiring.
I'm really pleased you brought this one up, Paul, actually, because I've been thinking about this just yesterday, actually, because on the, I don't know if you've ever listened to the Beyond Good podcast. It's a couple of teachers in the UK do a weekly podcast. But one of them visited Pratesh's school last week. So this week's episode was them reflecting, and they watched Pratesh teach. And Pratesh is a science teacher, and that he described it. He watched him teach two lessons, and he said these were comfortably the two best science lessons he'd ever seen in his life. And he talked through what Pratesh does in there. So it's fascinating listen for anyone who wants to listen to that. I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
I didn't know about that podcast, but the person you're talking about is Matt.
Yeah, of course. He's doing a bit of StepLab stuff, isn't he?
Who is now working with StepLab, and he was actually there doing the filming of Pratesh's lessons for StepLab.
Nice.
And I haven't managed to get my hands on that footage yet, but I've been asking for it, and I'm super excited to see those lessons.
Oh, I'd love to. If I can get a pirated copy of that, that'd be amazing. And yeah, Ol, if you can send the link to the Twitter thread as well, that'd be amazing. I'll bang that in the show notes. So yeah, just a couple of reflections on this, because as I said, I've been thinking about this a fair bit. So I was the same as you. When I first heard this idea, I was like, ever all hands up cold calling. I was like, I'm not 100% on that. Having spoke to Pratesh, my understanding is there are three reasons to do it. The first is energy. So Pratesh describes, which classroom would you rather be in? One where students are sat still with their hands down waiting to be called upon, or another classroom where 30 kids have got their hands in the air desperate to be called upon. Second is it gives you a sense of participation. This is what you were alluding to there. Without the faff of mini whiteboards. So it's you can get a sense of who, obviously it's not going to be as accurate because it's who thinks they know the answer, but it's still, as you say, a data point that you can get with no equipment needed. And the third, and I think this is the most interesting, is it informs the next move that you make. And I think this is really smart. So Pratesh said, and he distinguishes between two types of questioning, a check for listening and a check for understanding question. So if you ask a check for understanding question, like who thinks they can tell me the area of this triangle? If every single child or the vast majority of kids put their arms in the air, then you just can say, okay, let's do a quick cold call. I'm going to pick a child at random or whatever. But if only half the hands go in the air, That's really interesting to know. So then what Pritesh would do is he'd do a turn and talk. Say, okay, tell the person next to you, what do you think? And then after the turn and talk, now put your hand up in the air if you think you know the area of this triangle. So it's a really good kind of... And then third scenario, if no one puts their hand up in the air or only one or two, that tells the teacher, well, you know what? There's no point me asking these kids this now. I've probably not communicated this well enough. So, okay, hands down, everybody. Let me try and explain it. Now who thinks they can tell me? So... I think that's a really powerful use of it, this kind of giving you that data point to inform your next move. But to kind of double down on the point that you made earlier on, if you're asking a check for listening question and kids don't put their hand up, it's purely a sign of a lack of effort or a lack of engagement. So that kind of needs dealing with in a different way than if a child doesn't put their hand up to a check for understanding question. And yeah, I did ask Pritesh this, and he did talk about how it would be dealt with outside of the classroom more than inside of the classroom. The follow-up question I asked, because I didn't see that as a bigger problem as kids realizing pretty quickly, if they don't put their hand up, Sir's going to catch up with them at lunch, so I might as well just put my hand up and just gamble anyway, right? Which is, for me, the fundamental problem with cold call is, in theory, it's supposed to mean that every kid's thinking, but I think kids just gamble and think there's 30 kids in this class. That's a pretty low chance of me being picked. So I'll either just sit there looking like I'm thinking, or if I'm in Pritesh's classroom, I'll put my hand up and just hope he doesn't pick me. And in that case, I think we use Sammy Kempner's idea that he talked about on your podcast and then when he came on mine, of making sure you ask the student least likely to know the answer. So you pick the kid who you suspect is just doing that, or you suspect may get the answer wrong and so on, just to give you a bit more of a valid either check for understanding or check for listening. But I think it's a really interesting idea. When I do a CPD on cold call, it's always the bonus thing at the end, a little twist. So I do like 20 tips to do kind of standard cold call effectively, and then I say, right, you ready to just kind of your whole world to fall apart here, because let's just flip this on its head. Because I set up cold call as the opposite to hands up, right, volunteer, but then the final twist is actually one of the highest performing teachers in the country says that what I'm talking about here is rubbish and we should do hands up cold call. And it's always interesting, the feedback I often get is maybe with my year sevens, but not with my year 11s or year 13s and so on. But I know Pritesh does it with all year groups. And again, who am I to say that it's not the thing to do? So yeah, thanks for bringing that up, mate. Don't know if you have any kind of reflections on any of that.
Yeah, three, but I probably won't remember all three by the time I finish one. So let's start with the one I've written down, because I've already forgotten the other two. Your point there, it informs the next move. I think what we've been emphasizing in this discussion is that it informs the next move at two levels. So the one you were talking about that Pritesh emphasized at the start in the podcast there was it informs the next move, like in the moment, about mm-hmm. how the teacher's immediately going to reflect. And I think the thing that really struck me was that it informs the next move, like, a little bit broader, like let's call it on the day. So like, what's the teacher going to do after the lesson, or maybe it informs the next move after the lesson. And for me, that was the real revelation, because the in the moment thing seemed obvious to me just because of the idea of checks for understanding more broadly, but on the day was a real hard hitter. Interesting, linking back to your ideas from before about don't use prototypical examples exclusively, or don't choose examples that avoid spawning misconceptions. A provocation to you, Craig, should it be at the end of introducing 20 tips for cold calling that you introduce the idea of hands up cold calling, or should it be at the start as a more general example? I don't know. Whoa. I don't know the answer to that question.
Good twist. Okay, yeah. I'll think about that. Love that.
And then the third thing I have somehow managed to remember just comes back to that, like calling on the student least likely to respond. Two things on that. Again, I'll try to remember them both. Okay, I've forgotten the first one already. So let's go to the second. It's actually extremely hard when you're sick trying to retain a thread. I actually did that quite. I remember one particular sequence of questioning with one boy in a year 8 maths class, and I didn't have to do hands up cold calling. I could see he was looking out the window, And I cold called him and he was like, oh, and I was like, oh, let's call him Owen. Owen, just make sure you're tuned in, mate. I'm going to ask you again in a moment, blah, blah, blah. Asked him again. He's like, oh, he got caught out again. And I just like brought him back, encouraged him to listen. And then like another minute later, I called him again and he was like, you can't do that, sir. It was like against the rules of asking questions of the class in terms of what he'd been exposed to. So that's just like an interesting thing to kind of prepare students for as well, I guess.
Nice. Love it all. Good one, that one. Right. Should I do my second one then?
Please.
Now, I think you'll enjoy this because this is a callback to something you spoke about when we chatted. Might even been episode one or episode two or something like this of this kind of spin-off series that we're doing. And that is your tip. I think the way you phrased it was plan for the in-between times. And the point you were making was it's all well and good having good CPD in the moment, but it's what happens after that CPD ends. What happens in the in-between times before then either the second part of that CPD or sometimes that you don't even get to a second part of CPD. It's just, you know, that kind of one-hit wonder and it's what happens in the in-between times. So I'm going to start with a sad story, y'all. Something happened when I visited a school recently, and then what I've done as a result of that, okay? And as a little teaser, this is my, I need a good name for this, it's kind of my 5-point charter that I'm going to ask all head teachers to sign up to before I go in to do any work with schools, okay? So I visited a school recently where 6 weeks previously I'd visited, and I'd done my usual departmental day where I'd spent the morning watching lessons, trying to identify what's a really kind of big hitting improvement we can make that's doable. And then I got the whole team together in the afternoon and we did some CPD based on that. And it was the do now. Their do now was all over the show. People were doing different types of questions, different lengths of questions. Some was going on for 25 minutes, some was 5 minutes, some was books, some was whiteboards and blah, blah, blah. So I sat down with the head of department. And I showed them the photos of all this and she was like, oh, wow, okay, I didn't realize it was going on like that. So I said, right, I reckon if we can solve the do now, it's going to help solve a lot of other problems because it's going to get teachers checking for understanding. It's going to get kids focused, blah, blah, blah. Pace is going to be up. So we sat down and we agreed some kind of key principles that we wanted everyone in the department to do for their do now. So working out in books, final answer on mini whiteboards, 4 questions. Everyone does 4 questions, their retrieval questions, all these kind of things. Head of department, more than happy with it. I then presented the CPD. We did some rehearsal. Everyone planned for their next do now that they were going to do. Nodding, smiling, everything's looking great, right? I'd said to the deal I'd said was try it on your own for a week with one class, then come back together as a department, reflect on what's working, what isn't working, and then the head of department can do some lesson drop-ins, find some examples of excellence, blah, blah, blah. Everything great. So I come back 6 weeks later with the idea in my head being I'm going to do some morning drop-ins of lessons. The do now will be sorted. So then we can move on to the next thing, whether it's doing the explanation phase or whatever it may be. Lo and behold, what happens when I go around is the do-nows are almost as varied as what I saw on my first visit. It's some people are doing 8 questions, not a mini whiteboard in sight in some of the classes. And I was like, right, okay. So after lesson 2, after I'd seen about 10 lessons, I said to the head of the department, can we just have a chat? What's happened here? And she said, well, not a lot really, because everyone tried their do now for a week, but then our departmental meeting got cancelled because there was a whole school CPD session that we had to go to. I then couldn't do my lesson drop-ins because I got put on cover for this, and this. Then we had a whole school initiative got launched on a new behaviour system, so everyone's attention was on that, and things just fizzled out. And she was real down about it, and I was real down about it, because then it was like a tricky thing, because we couldn't really, I thought, well, what's the point in doing anything else, right? What's the point in trying to solve explanations and worked examples and stuff when the same thing's just going to happen? So I've seen versions of this. That was the most extreme case, but I've seen versions of this in quite a few of the schools I've visited, where what happens on the day is all well and good, but to your point, the in-between times, that's where the problems lie. So Here's my solution to this. This is my Mr. Barton 5-point charter that people have to sign up to for me to come in. Now, I've not launched this yet, so what, like most of my ideas, I want to run them by you first, because sometimes you spot some problem with them or something like that. So this has not gone live yet. I'm going to put this in a newsletter so it's public, and then every booking I'm going to refer them to this, and if they can't agree to this, then I'm not coming in, right? So here we go. So the first is, I'm going to ask head teachers or SLT, whoever it is, to commit that for the first week, nobody goes into anyone's room. It's a low stakes experiment for the individual teachers just to try out this technique with any class they want. And I recommend that they try and do it 3 times within that week, but nobody's judging them, nobody's monitoring them or anything. And the idea there is to keep that barrier to entry as low as possible. Because what sometimes happens in some schools is I do the CPD on the Wednesday, and on Thursday, it's almost like a formal lesson observation where people are dropping in to see this new technique, and it's just like, it's madness. So 1 week, low stakes experiment where nobody goes near anybody's classroom, unless the teacher specifically asks somebody to come in and watch and so on and so forth, okay? So that's point one of the charter. Point two is the head teachers must commit that after that week, the maths department can come together for at least half an hour to reflect on it, and that half an hour cannot be in addition to anything else that they're supposed to do. So they've got to find this half an hour. So either give them this half hour back from some whole school thing that perhaps they don't need to be in or so on. This needs to be, it can't be just an additional time commitment that the maths department needs to make. And this is their opportunity to reflect on what worked, what didn't work, and so on and so forth. So that's number two. Number three, I then ask for it to be facilitated for paired lesson drop-ins the following week. So when I do my departmental CPD now, I should have said this at the start, it's always in pairs, like the department are all sat together in pairs till we do the rehearsal and so on. So I ask each partner to have opportunity to go and see their partner in action doing this technique. Now, that doesn't need to be for the full lesson. So for the do now, it's a case of freeing up for 10 minutes max, something like that. So SLT can do that. They can just come and sit in someone's lesson for 10 minutes and then they come back and so on and so forth, or facilitate it with cover. But I ask them to commit to that, to allow everybody to see at least one other person in action, them to see them in action, and then they can have a chat about it to kind of give feedback and so on. So that's the third one, paired lesson drop-ins. Fourth one, I then want the head of department to be freed up to do the lesson drop-ins the following week, so that they can then see examples of good practice, non-examples, and so on and so forth. Now, that's normally the easiest one because most heads of department have time to do that. But in some schools, heads of department literally have no time to do that because there's loads of other things happening. So again, I want a commitment that the head of department can drop round and see. And again, if it's the do now, it's not doing like 5 lesson observations. It's doing choosing 5 lessons, but then just, you know, running into 2 or 3 do nows in the first 10 minutes of those lessons. And then finally, the final commitment, and then I'll run through all these again, is I ask that the department don't be given anything else big to focus on until this is embedded. So no new big initiative or anything like that. Let's just get this nailed for the half term or whatever it is before we start introducing anything new. So my 5 points are low stakes experiment for the first week where teachers just have a chance to just try things out without any pressure. Departmental reflection of at least 30 minutes that isn't in addition to anything else. Paired lesson drop-ins, so you get to see somebody else in action and get some feedback on what you're doing. Again, that isn't anything to be recorded or anything like that. That's low stakes, just conversation that's happening. That's really important. Head of department lesson drop-ins, so the head of department can get a sense of what's working and what isn't, and then a commitment to focus on one thing and one thing only instead of any other big initiative. So my plan is to put that out. I've written all that up as kind of a newsletter. I'll link to that on my CPD booking page. And if whoever's booking me can't commit to that, I'm going to say, I'm really sorry, there's no point me coming in. Because to take Adam Boxer's point, and he says it a lot more sternly than me, this is public money that's being paid for me to come in. And if you're not going to do the follow-up in the in-between times, you're wasting your money. You're wasting our money. What do you reckon to that all?
Yeah, I think the idea of having some sort of charter or something like that at the outset to manage expectations is an awesome idea. And I think what you've got there captures a lot of what I've found to be important as well. Definitely, let's dive into a few of them a bit more. So the first week, nobody goes into others' rooms. I think the idea of like keeping barrier to entry low is really good. I guess the only thing I'd wonder about that is like sometimes people find it more motivating to have others in their room. Sometimes they find it demotivating. Do you think there would be any potential negative effects of kind of suggesting that that's a mandated rule if there's already a culture of dropping in and things like that?
Yeah, so the way I frame it is I said, look, if you want to have somebody in your room, that's absolutely fine, but there's no pressure. It's to stop that other thing, right? It's to stop it being, right, let's go in and watch this before teachers have had time. So if there's a culture of drop-ins already happening and they're comfortable, or even within a department, if one or two teachers like having someone in, then that's absolutely fine. But the point I make there is there's no obligation for that at all. Mm-hmm. And the incentive is going to come later, right? Because I should have said this as well. What I ask people to do during this kind of low stakes experiment period is to make notes of what working, what isn't working, so that when they come together as a department, they've got something concrete to talk about. So you've got that incentive already, because you know in a week's time, you're going to come together and reflect on this. And then also the following week, you know you're going to have somebody in your room. So I think the incentives are there. There's enough incentive to try it for that week without the kind of barrier or the fear or whatever of somebody kind of coming in to watch. So I think it seems to work all right, that one.
Yeah, cool. Maybe like some wording around no drop-ins in addition to business as usual or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah. That's good.
I think the idea of like mandating that additional meeting of like you've specified there 30 minutes following the first week, great idea. And like nothing keeps momentum going like a booked in meeting. Could you ask for more time than 30 minutes?
So 30 is my minimum, right? It's just honestly, I don't know what it's like in Oz, but it breaks my heart this. I was speaking to somebody about this the other week. So in my first two schools, we used to have one departmental meeting per week. It was after school. It used to last, I think an hour was the max. We'd normally be wrapped up with, 30, 45 minutes, something like that. And a lot of that time was wasted in reflection, doing admin stuff. But towards the end, we were doing some really good CPD stuff with that, right? So I visit schools these days, and it is not rare for a school for a maths department to get together maybe once a half term, so once every 6 weeks, at most twice during those 6 weeks. But I'd say once every 6 weeks is maybe the norm, or certainly like a really common thing. So it's just not feasible. So 30 minutes feels like if I mean, I'd love an hour, I'd love 90 minutes, but 30 minutes feels like something I can ask for, whereas anything more might be pushing it a little bit. What is it like in Oz there, Roll? If you were to visit a typical school, how often would the department get together? I'm not talking here, by the way, because some schools, they ask staff to come in. There's like a culture in the maths department where every Wednesday morning we all agree to come in like an hour early to meet. I'm not talking that. I'm talking about actual kind of mandated time for the department to get together.
Yeah, it's really school by school. And I mean, there's, union rules generally, if they're public schools, around how many hours people can be asked to attend meetings and things like that. But then it's up to the school. And mm-hmm. So schools that are well managed will allocate that time predominantly to teaching and learning and development and things like that, and poorly managed schools will waste a lot of that time. I guess my pushback would be around how long do you think it will take for them to have a meaningful discussion, and using that as a criteria rather than how long can most schools squeeze in. And keeping in mind that hopefully, and I would imagine that you are getting asked by many more schools to come and do work with them than you can. And so in many ways, you are trying to create a filter that means that your time is being used somewhere in the places that it can have the biggest impact. And so, I would encourage you to be like more demanding rather than less, because that's like, it'll mean that the schools that you get are even better correlated with the ones who are more likely to be successful and take on your advice.
Good point, mate. Good point.
How long do you usually work with schools for? Is there like a...
So dream, I normally try and push for 6 days minimum, and more often these days is I try and do them in consecutive days, just because you can get some real good stuff going there. You can keep the momentum going. But yeah, the lowest, I mean, some schools just want a random one-off day, which again, I try and advise against. But I'd say typically would be maybe 3 days. It would be 3 days over the course of a term, something like that.
Okay. Cool. Just because I thought that the department isn't given anything else big to focus on until it's embedded, I think is potentially a tricky one for a principal to say sure, because that's an indefinite period of time. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if there's a way to make that more of a concrete thing.
Yeah. Okay.
Is it a term? Is it a term reasonable? Based upon what you're likely to do, or is 4 weeks? I'm not sure.
Yeah, good idea. Yeah, I think probably 6 weeks is probably doable for most of these things. Yeah, that's really good. I'll make that more concrete. Yeah, that's good.
But yeah, I mean, apart from those couple little comments, I think that the spirit of the letter is there, which is awesome. And I think it's a really good example for anyone doing work with schools. And it's the kind of thing conversation you have with parents when they send their student to your school, isn't it? It's these are the expectations. This is what it's going to take for your child to be successful here. And this is how it's going to look. Are you keen to buy in? And that's a great thing to do.
I mean, my business could absolutely fall off a cliff. That's the only problem if nobody signs up for it. But we'll see.
So maybe I'll be just go back to lots of one day talks, mate.
Exactly. So I'll be launching that after the Easter holidays. So watch out for that, everybody. All right, Al, what have you got for your second and final idea? Right.
Yeah. So this week, some may have seen it. Tom Sherrington came out with a post on classroom management. I think I saw that you'd commented on that, Craig. Really, really interesting post, and a post in which Tom kind of, I guess it's probably fair to say, he admitted that he struggled to turn a school around on the behaviour front, even though despite working hard on that for several years, I got the sense, and he kind of broke that down in a number of ways. But one of the things that he said came out most strongly, and I'll just read an excerpt because I think it's relevant both for school leaders but also for teachers. He said, "I think I failed personally, mainly in one very important aspect. I didn't invest enough of myself in building the rapport with students needed so that they could accept the systems we were introducing. Whilst I think teachers should be able to rely on a system in a fairly neutral manner without putting undue pressure on their personal relationship building capacity, for leaders, I think this is different. Leaders need to model hands-on engagement, showing how to blend systematic, consistent response and relationship building." So what I take out of that is, I mean, in the book that that's just come out by Mark Daly and myself, which hopefully we'll have a chat with you about soon, Craig, the principle that we put in it that kind of captures that is students need to know that they belong and you believe in them. And it actually kind of cycles back to the point from Pratesh earlier, right? It's if students aren't putting their hand up to say, I'm willing to have a crack at this, more needs to be done to build that buy-in first. But I think it's important to mention it in this context, because as more and more comes out about effective classroom management or behavior management, techniques and strategies, a lot of that relational and human side can be lost. And I think it actually doesn't work. I would say I have been many different teachers throughout my teaching career. I was the first year, really excited, I'm your mate teacher, which worked with some classes and didn't work at all with others. I've been that teacher. I've also been the teacher with extremely good routines and fantastic relationships with my students at the same time. I have also been the teacher with an overemphasis on routines and an insufficient emphasis on relationships, and struggled with classroom management in those classes as a result, and had a not very enjoyable time as a result, right? So I've actually felt what it's like to be all of those without necessarily having the perspective at each individual time of what was happening and what was going on, and only at the twilight of each era realizing what had just happened. And so I think this point from Tom is such an important one. It's interesting he caches it like it's something that leaders have to do more so. I do think that school systems of behavior and cultural expectations should be strong enough that a teacher who isn't naturally as good as might be ideal about building relationships should be able to expect a well-behaving class regardless. But I don't think that removes the need for every teacher to kind of see the importance of this as well. So yeah, it thanks to Tom for sharing this. It really, I'm sure it resonated with lots of people. It really resonated with me. And I think it's like this constant push and pull. It's this constant push and pull between like being strict, being clear, being assertive, and also like being fun, having a laugh, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm always grateful for being reminded of the need to strike that balance. And yeah, I was keen to hear your thoughts on it as well, Craig.
Yeah, really good one. I was thinking whether I should reflect on behavior thing. So I'm really glad you brought this up. Yeah, I love the post. I thought, I love anything where, I mean, it was the whole spirit of my first book, how I wish I'd done something differently, you know, and it's great for someone of kind of Tom's stature to be humble like that in a post. So I thought it was great. That bit was a bit I highlighted as well, amongst many other things. I thought that was really interesting. So just a couple of reflections, well, a reflection and a kind of question. So I think I've told you this story before, Al, but I was doing some work in some schools in the northeast of England, an academy chain, and there was five secondary schools, and one of them out of the five was outperforming the rest with a similar cohort of kids. They're absolutely destroying them in terms of maths results, real significant difference. So I visited the other four schools first, and everyone was saying, oh, they're doing something amazing in that school. They're doing something amazing. And what was happening was lots of the other heads of department were being sent to this other school to try and figure out what they were doing differently. And they were coming back saying, I don't know what it is. Like, it's not like they've got booklets. It's not like they're doing anything radically different in lessons. So I went and visited, and it was purely the behavior. It was the systems that were in place. Like, but it wasn't like draconian or anything like that. It was the teachers were having fun. They're having laughs with the kids, but there was a real clear system in place. So the kids knew exactly what the line was. And if they crossed that line, what was going to happen. And it wasn't done in an oppressive way or anything like that. As I say, the teachers were having as much of a laugh as any of the teachers I'd seen, but the kids knew how far they could kind of push things and what the expectations were. And the problem with that was, I don't think you can, you certainly can't replicate that, well, I don't think anyway, on an individual teacher level. Like, it's very, very hard to bring in those systems yourself as an individual teacher. Maybe as a department, it can be like the way things are done in this department. But if it's not done on a whole school level, you're kind of screwed. So these heads of department were coming back and like, they couldn't really take anything from the experience because, you know, that wasn't what their whole kind of school kind of culture was set up to be. Just a slight tangent on this before I ask you my question, Al. One thing I've been thinking about a fair bit, I interviewed Jo Morgan. I put it out yesterday. She's a maths teacher in the UK in a very high performing comprehensive school. But what's interesting there is that was a new school. So they started up, they opened up with just year sevens, then they took in year sevens and eights, year sevens, eights and nines, and now they're up to year 12s. And the reason that resonates is because the conversation that your mate Matt and Femi had about Pritesh's school, is Pritesh's school was a new school as well. And there's something about opening a new school where you can set those expectations, you can set up those systems much, much easier than if you kind of go in as a head teacher and try and take over a school where it's in trouble and there's already a kind of culture and systems in place. And there are obviously challenges to starting new schools up and so on, but you certainly have that advantage of kind of being able to set up those systems. And going back to what you said before about expectations, you can tell parents very clearly what the expectations are, and they haven't already been tainted by what the expectations were last year or 3 years ago or whatever it was. So that's just a bit of a ramble, but the point I wanted to make here is, how much of this do you think, and I think this is a bit underrated, is making sure kids know the purpose of the kind of behavior systems that there are in schools? Because I often do this little experiment of asking kids what the purpose of things are. So I'll say to kids, why do you think Sir's doing this do now at the start of the lesson? And they never say, it's so we can remember things that we might forget. They say things like, oh, to keep us busy, or so we can do the register, or something like that. Like, kids very rarely know the purpose of what they're doing. And I think that's true of behavior, right? Like, I wonder whether people listening here, if you were to ask a child, what's the purpose of this behavior system? Why do we have these C1s and C2s and so on? I'm not sure they'd be able to answer it. And if you don't know the purpose, it's very hard to get buy-in, right? It's very hard. You're just then relying on kids to just trust you that you're doing it for the right reason. And it just seems a bit of a missed opportunity. So I just wonder, you know far more about this stuff than I do, Al. Where does purpose and that knowledge of that purpose, where does that come? Where does that fit in terms of getting this kind of behavior and this culture where, you know, kids can thrive?
Mm. Thanks for bringing that up, Craig. In fact, that's something that I was really keen to draw out of the excerpt from Tom. But unfortunately, the notes I made this week were insufficiently comprehensive because I decided to go back to bed for another half an hour before this podcast rather than spending more time on my notes. But I couldn't agree more. And in fact, I think I summarized that two episodes ago when my first takeaway was change is only sustainable if it's supported by deep understanding.
Yeah.
I think at that time I was talking about that in the context of like trying to change your staff views on things and educate them and so on. But yeah, incredibly true for students as well. And I think that it's not hard to include that in your messaging to students, to like add an additional sentence at the start of something or at the end of something. Remember, we're doing this to make the most of our learning time today, whatever it might be. But it's extremely easy to forget to add that. And that's because it's like it's a curse of knowledge thing, isn't it? It's so obvious to us as teachers why we're doing these things. To students, it's just like school. For many students, school is just like a sequence of things that each of which makes no sense, right? It's just like that's the story of their lives at that period in time. And so the more we can move away from that and explain the purpose of it, and I think the more the better.
Love it all. Fantastic. Yeah, we'll definitely get you and Mark, or just you or however we do it, on the show to talk about your book. Or do you know what, John Cat, they don't send me any books these days, right? So I have to like beg authors to like get versions of books. Absolutely ridiculous.
I haven't even got a copy of it yet, mate.
When I was famous a few years ago, when I was selling a load of books, I was getting sent them left, right and centre, and I have to go out and beg. Anyway, right, but yeah, we'll get you on the show for that one. Right, should I do my final one, Al?
I'd love to hear it.
Right, so this one, it could be like a 10 second one, this, but we'll see what your take of it is. So this is another newsletter that I'm kind of working on at the moment that I want to get your take on. I need a catchy clickbait title for this. At the moment, I'm calling it something like The Teacher Problem, or I don't know. I need something decent for it, but I'll tell you what it is. We'll worry about the clickbaity title later, right? The Teacher Mistake or something like that it might be, right? So here's something I see a lot that I think is a mistake and is a generality that applies to quite a few teachers. I've fallen into this trap and I wonder what your take of it is. I think, I'm going to read this out. Many teachers spend too long on questions where understanding is secure and not enough time on questions where understanding is not secure. And the analogy I draw here is with running. So I do a fair bit of running. And the kind of big cliche that gets mentioned in running is that the mistake most runners make is they run their easy runs too hard and their hard runs too easy. And I think it's a similar thing here, right? So what I often see, and there's two reasons for this, by the way, that I'll go into in a second. But what I often see is we take the do now. So we're talking about the do now. Let's say question one on the do now is adding fractions and everyone knows how to do it. What typically happens is the teacher still asks a couple of questions and still models how to do it. Then we get to question two, which is on solving equations where the kids don't have a bloody clue what's going on. What does the teacher do? Ask a couple of questions, models it. They spend roughly the same amount of time on those two things, which is madness. It's madness, right? And I think there's two reasons this happens. The first is, on a practical level, not enough teachers use mini whiteboards to kind of get that sense of where understanding's at. They're relying on cold call or they're relying on hands up, and therefore they don't know where that understanding is, so that they kind of play it safe and just kind of spend the same amount of time on each question. So that's kind of reason one. But reason two is the more interesting one, I think. And that is, even when you've got the data that everyone seems to have got it, teachers can't resist probing a bit more, either asking a few more questions or just modeling it just in case it hasn't quite sunk in. And what happens there is that time you're spending there is then eating into the time that you need to spend or will be better allocated on a question where kids struggle. So yeah, just to repeat that, many teachers spend too long on questions where understanding is secure and not enough time on questions where understanding is not secure. That's my hypothesis. That's what I'm seeing a lot. I've fallen foul of that. What's your take on?
Yeah, and I think that Graham Nuttall in the book The Hidden Lives of Learners like actually quantified this. It was something like, I was just searching for it then, but I don't actually have it in my notes. I think it's something along the lines of, and this is going to be completely wrong, but something like students already knew like 75% of the content that was taught, like on average of the lessons that Nuttall analyzed. And this is a guy who like went into hundreds of lessons with a video camera, mic'd up every single student and like analyzed what every one of them knew in relation to what was being taught. So I think that like what you're saying is borne out in the data in a lot of ways. I think in some cases it's one of the eternal challenges of teaching. So like it is a teacher mistake, but it's also a result of a persistent problem in teaching, which is that you can't teach to the top all the time. Like you have to teach in such a way that is both accessible and stretching students. And so how to overcome that is a challenge. I think something we were talking about earlier today in terms of starting with the broadest generalization is actually way around this, because if you can teach something that's more new, if you're teaching a more comprehensive process and teaching it once, if that makes sense, than if you do it the other way. So I think that in some ways addresses it, but I also think that there is just something intrinsic to like whole class teaching that's going to happen a bit. But what do you think? Is there a way around it?
No, I think the first is just realizing that it's happening, and I don't think enough teachers realize this. And the way I always phrase it is this opportunity cost, right? Like if we had an infinite amount of time, then it wouldn't be as big a problem to spend a good chunk of time on a question that the vast majority of kids know. But the opportunity cost of that is the fact that we're not going to be able to spend time on the question that the kids really struggle with. And it's having the, I don't know, confidence is the wrong word, but it's saying, do you know what? All right, I don't know for definite that everyone knows how to do this, but I have a fairly good signal that most do. So I'm just going to gamble here and I'm going to crack on for this, because there's a chances are in 5 minutes time, we're going to come across something that not enough students know the answer to, and I'm going to need that time. And I'll tell you what, it's really interesting. It plays out a lot in the Do Now, where that's like the start of the lesson. So you've got a whole hour ahead of you, right? So you're not worrying about the clock as much and so on and so forth. And often you do get questions, if you pitch your Do Now right, where kids can do the first two questions really, really quickly. So it's so tempting just to think, well, no harm in spending an extra 30 seconds, minute on this. So I think the realization is the first thing that this is happening. Because I was doing some early coaching with a teacher who this was happening in his lesson. And he was adamant that, well, it's fine. Like, I want to probe. I want to go deeper. And it's only when I then showed him the evidence of how long he then spent on a question where kids didn't know. And this goes back to what we always talk about, that pivotal evidence, right? Because he'd spent, I think it was something like 7.5 minutes on a question that everyone knew how to do. Mm. And 4 minutes on a question that kids didn't have a bloody clue how to do. It was only with that pivotal evidence that he was like, all right, actually, okay, we need to do something about it. So it's a realization thing. But as I say, just going back to those two other reasons, if you don't have that data, from the mini whiteboards or whatever, you don't know what scenario you're in. So you can't even make that decision. And again, I think that's the first thing, the first hurdle you've got to get over. Let's make sure we've actually got that data. And once we've got it, are we then happy? What's our threshold? Are we happy if we see most boards have got the right answer to wrap this up in 10 seconds? Or are we actually going to spend a minute on it? And yeah, you're kind of almost setting a few little kind of rules for yourself, I think, is important for this.
Yeah, that's a good point. And yeah, I didn't sufficiently acknowledge your excellent point on how probing is often a way that it's done. I was kind of addressing the question more so in terms of like the question set that had been chosen for students in terms of reinforcing knowledge or whatever. But that issue of kind of probing to content that students are obviously secure on, rather than just efficiently moving to the next thing, is an excellent point. I think something we've got to make sure is not lost, and not that you were alluding to this at all, but it's kind of a way we can potentially acknowledge something a teacher's doing, but then move them towards a more efficient way of doing it, is acknowledging the power of overlearning as well. Because often we do actually want students to like just attain some immense level of fluency with content so that it's taking up no, cognitive capacity essentially, and they can be freed up to think about more complex things. Yet, we want to make sure that that's done in a way that's as time efficient as possible. So, you know, Sammy Kempner gets another mention today, and his use of chants and things like that, really powerful on that front. I think there's also another motivating factor that it's valuable to reflect upon if we're trying to get teachers to change their behavior on this front. And that's like how it feels to probe a knowledge bite that you know students know. Especially when someone's watching your lesson, right? So it feels really nice to spend 7.5 minutes talking about this thing that you all know, and every kid you call on has an answer to the question, and you look like you're doing a great job, right? And so it's also, I think, yeah, kind of acknowledging or in some way addressing that as a step to changing that behavior is potentially necessary or helpful as well.
That's really nice. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, that's kind of seductive nature of, yeah, you're asking questions you know kids are going to be getting right. Everyone loves that. Everyone feels great. That's great. Yeah, that's really nice. Yeah. Love that, Ol. Love that. Right, Ol. Well, that brings us to the end of the main show there. You've done well there. You've come out with some of your best insights there. You need to get ill more often. That was, you're quite profound there, mate. That was very impressive, that. So we're going to move on to the bonus pod now for Ollie's Patreons. I'll give you a little teaser of the bonus question, a bit of a controversial one this. Ollie WhatsApped me this morning, and it just came to me because I've been flicking through Twitter. So what I'm going to ask Ollie there is, what in the world of education do you think is overrated? So could all be kicking off there. So that'll be for Ollie's Patreon listeners. But we're going to wrap up the main pod now. Ol, you've got your books out now. Just tell people a little bit about that.
Yeah, the Classroom Management Handbook with Dr. Mark Dowley. I wrote a first co-authored book. It was good fun working with Mark on it. Basically, we just wanted to come up with a book that was more like a really short, accessible pamphlet for people that, you know, when they're facing a specific scenario in the classroom, they can pick it up, open it, and find essentially a script and a bit of a recipe that's going to help them out in that specific scenario. So, if that sounds interesting to people, we'd welcome you to check it out.
No, I can't comment on this. I've not yet received a copy of this from John Catt, as per usual. But fingers crossed, when I read it, we'll get Ollie and Mark on the show to chat about that. Usual thing, Ollie's Ed Threads. Make sure you subscribe to those and my Tips for Teacher and ED newsletter. Got some biggies coming up on the ED newsletter. Got the one on my charter of things that I'm going to ask head teachers to sign up to. I wrote one recently about walking, talking mocks. So if you've not checked that one out and you're thinking about end of term exams, GCSEs and all that kind of thing, check those out. But you can find those in the show notes. Right. It is farewell from me and Ollie Lovell.
Thanks, team. Chat next time.